right, gentlemen. Pete Dean, this is Solder Smoke. Pete, what's the number?
251. Crank it in, Robert. Crank it in, Ralph.
All right, it's Monday, 4-1-24. Wow, we're here on a Monday, man. This is fantastic. Good to see you guys so early in the morning. All right, I think we're going to start with a little travelogue. Dean, our friend Dean, has been up at the North Pole. Dean, tell us about it.
I took a three-day Northern Lights cruise from Tromsø, Norway to Kirkenes, 12 kilometers from the Russian border. We went on a dog sled ride, was happy that the dogs didn't turn right instead of left. Got us back to the ice hotel. This is a hotel made entirely of ice and snow, and does not look like a place where I would want to sleep, but it is absolutely gorgeous inside. And then for three nights, we were out on a cruise ship up in the Sea of Norway, and all clouds, no lights, and some rain and some snow. And then on the last night, in the last few minutes, I had like 3 hours to go. The captain comes on and says, "The lights are visible." And of course, the entire ship rushes to the aft of the ship where there's a viewing port, and you're kind of scrambling, and I'm trying to get my tripod set up to get my, but I got some great pictures of the Northern Lights. But I learned something interesting. The Northern Lights trackers use the K index. They call it the KP index, the polar index, which is an average of the K index. And of course they use it the opposite of the way we use it. They like high K numbers for the Northern Lights, and we like low K numbers. So There's the radio connection.
I always thought KP was K planetary, kind of
planetary.
An aggregate, right. an aggregate of all the K's. Yeah. Well, very cool. I have a picture. I have one of your pictures. I think I'm going to use it as the lead picture for this podcast. So,
yeah,
wow.
It's interesting when you're taking a picture of the lights. It'd be nice to take them from the land. So I'm in addition to my radio hobby, I do photography, and I get frustrated because the mountains are blurry and they should be sharp, but they can't be sharp because I'm on a moving boat and I got a 5 second exposure.
Yeah, but the lights look great.
The lights look beautiful.
It look fantastic. It reminded me a bit, the colors that you saw there, the colors in that picture reminded me a little bit of what I saw back in 1972, August 1972. I still keep getting emails about this. When I think the aurora reached all the way down into New York City area.
Oh yeah.
So great stuff.
Well, we
all
were
right.
Supposed to get the Northern Lights here in Virginia in the last couple of days. Of course, this big solar storm, but didn't happen.
It's a good thing you went up to the North Pole to catch them there, Dean. Very good. Hey, listen, the other bit of information in the general, I guess we're in the general news category right now. We have received the first ever Color Burst Liberation Army call to arms.
Who?
Yes. It's quite exciting. Dave Richards, AA7EE, who is a really fantastic photographer and blogger, amazing Manhattan surface mount QRP stuff, mostly Manhattan, using meat pads. But Dave sent us an email, and he said that he has been noticing the presence on our CBLA frequency of 3579, the color burst frequency, the frequency of all the Michigan Mighty Mites, by the way. He has been noticing an interloper, an intruder, a pirate on 3579. Somebody has set up a kind of bogus non-ham radio beacon on that frequency, sending a whole series of dots and then some nonsensical word, and it's sitting there just going all the time. Now, Dave has located it somewhere in the southwest United States, but that's a big neighborhood. So we have put information about this interloper up on the blog, the CBA call to arms, and we have asked for assistance in finding people who can kind of hear it, locate it, and hopefully triangulate it. Because you know what happens after we triangulate, right? You guys know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
we won't get into that, but suffice it to say, Dave Richards, our friend out there, on the left coast, by the way, up in the San Francisco, up in the Bay Area, has issued a CBLA call to arms. Thanks very much, Dave. Hey, Dean was off with Santa Claus up there in the North Pole during Winterfest. I mean, Winterfest down here. We have the big Hamfest of the Vienna Wireless
Society. My club's
Society.
Hamfest, yeah.
Yeah. And I managed to pick up a lot of goodies. And I picked up an MXM Industries 40-meter transceiver for $1. Look, I got it here. Let me show you. Because some of our viewers are on video. This is the thing. Look at that. Look at that. It is a thing of beauty. They look, I even saved. Look how they had it marked. Ha! I say, ha!
Yeah.
Look, parts, nothing. It works fine. And Pete, look how the frequencies are marked on there. Really beautiful. Ooh. Sharpie work. Nice with a Sharpie, man. It's a long way from an OLED screen. But I fired this thing up the other day, and I've made two contacts with it. So that was really good. I also got this is the big thing over here, a PAL VFO, an 11-meter PAL VFO. Again, $1. But man, look at that dial on there. That's worth it all. It's got a symbol that says, it's got like this, and it says, PAL means communications. It means. Anyway, I will soon legitimize this thing and turn it into a real piece of amateur radio equipment.
I don't know, Bill. I got to talk to the club. I got to get them to raise the price on that dollar bin.
The dollar
make
bin,
it,
man.
Make it $2.
You guys probably made at least half, you know, a dozen dollars on that bin there this week. So anyway, real good.
Dozens of dollars.
Thousands. Anyway, the other thing I want to mention was Gene Shepherd. You know, Gene Shepherd came up, and I forget exactly how it came up. I think I was talking to my wife about Gene Shepherd, and I mentioned to her that I had, wait a second, I know how it came up, because our good friend Armin, WA1UQO, gave me a whole stack of electric radio and Antique Wireless Association magazines at Winterfest, and one of the magazines contained a really good article about Gene Shepherd. This prompted me to think about Gene Shepherd, and I mentioned to my wife, I said, you know, I spoke to him once. I spoke to him on the WMCA call-in show back in the 1970s, and it was my only brief conversation with Shep. And then I mentioned to her also, I said, you know, amazingly, some guy found it and sent it to me, the recording. So I have the recording. And I went and I looked, and I think I played a bit of it during Solder Smoke 90, way back when. But then I checked my Gmail, because I figured it came to me via Gmail. And sure enough, there it is. The guy sent it to me, and I have the recording. So I put the recording up on the blog. And it's a 10-minute recording of Gene Shepherd appearing with Long John Nebel and Candy Jones. Candy Jones, by the way, Pete, I'm mentioning you. I'm thinking about you, Pete. Candy Jones was a pinup girl during the World War II. She was one of the most popular pinup girls. Yeah. Anyway, he was on with these two people, and I called in and spoke to him. The funny thing is, about 6 months later, I was also getting up for work early in the morning, and I was kind of groggy, and I'm listening, and wait a second, some other dude is calling in talking about ham radio with Gene Shepherd. Who the heck is that? It was me. It was a
wow.
But anyway, I have it up there, so if anybody wants to listen, it's a brief. You could hear my New York accent, which was still quite strong in 1976. I think I was 18 years old. And there it is. You can listen to it. And then finally, before we start the main portion of the show, you know, this gets us back to Dave Richards, because he's out there in the Bay Area. And, you know, we've been joking around a lot about the stickers. And we've been taking pictures of me putting the stickers and other people putting the stickers in New York City and Amsterdam and all over the world, people have been putting these stickers up. But, you know, I realized that we might have made a mistake here, because we have the website of the Solder Smoke blog on there. And this means that whoever sees it can track it down. So here's the story. Recently, well, back in November 23, I think it was, I was out there in San Francisco, and I encouraged my daughter to take us to the corner of Haight and Ashbury, because the famous Haight-Ashbury district in San Francisco. And I had a sticker in my wallet, and I took it out, and I put it up, and I took a picture. There we are, Haight and Ashbury. Solder Smoke at the corner of Haight and Ashbury. There it is, took a picture. You know, just a few weeks later, we get an email from Dave Richards, AA7EE. Dave says that he has gone to the corner of Haight and Ashbury and has looked for our sticker, right? He actually found, based on my picture, the lamppost on which I had placed the solder smoke sticker. No solder smoke sticker there. He sent us a picture, the sticker removed. So I've got the two pictures, with the sticker and without the sticker, and I'm putting them up on the blog today. You guys can check it out. That's not the end of the story. This is where it gets really kind of concerning. I got a letter. Yeah, I mean, I got a letter from the municipality of San Francisco, from the mayor's office. And the letter wasn't quite clear, but it implied the threat of legal action for, quote, defiling the streets of San Francisco.
Ooh.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine? Our little sticker has defiled the streets. Has anybody been to San Francisco lately? It'd be hard to defile that place. I know. But apparently they're serious about cracking down on what they call scoff laws. I guess it's sort of like the graffiti broken window movement that was started in New York a while back. But, you know, this is actually now a pretty serious threat, because the fines that they're talking about are actually pretty hefty for one little sticker. So this whole thing, I mean, it's terrible to have this kind of action kind of hanging over you. And, you know, this could actually put the whole solder smoke operation out of business for at least for a while. So,
well, I don't know. I'm sorry, but, you know, this is why I left California 20 years ago.
I
have family there. Pete's there. I know. Sorry, Pete, but it's California. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
It seems completely nuts, but they're going to do this. I mean, so listen, I think there's only way. I don't want to get into a whole big, you know, stink and make a federal case out of this.
People's Republic.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we could do is, if we just collected some testimonials, some people would send in emails saying how much the Solder Smoke podcast means to them, and, you know, why they think this action is unfair and why they think it should be dropped. I mean, obviously they've traced it to me because it's got soldersmoke.blogspot.com, and the IT people can quickly figure out who owns that website, which is me. So I'm the one who's on the hook for this. But please send in emails with kind of your thoughts on all this, and your thoughts on the Solder Smoke podcast, and how and the blog, and how important it is to you. Just send it to me at, you know, soldersmoke.yahoo.com. Soldersmoke, one word, soldersmoke.yahoo.com. And we'll pull them all together, and hopefully this will be something that I could add to the response. The response is due in a month or two. I think they give you 6 months, so I got like a month or two to respond before they start hitting me with some pretty nasty fines for defiling the streets of the city of San Francisco. Holy cow, what a mess. Anyway, enough of that. Sticky sticker trouble. Who knew? Who thought that the sticker could cause this much trouble? All right, Pete, time for your bench. Pete, you got some good stuff to mention.
Yeah. Well, hey, you mentioned the word PAL, the PAL VFO, PAL VFO. You know, that's an electronic term, PAL. Did you know that?
What's the term? What's it mean?
Phase alternate line. And that's one of the standards for television. You have NTSC.
European TV, yeah.
And PAL, phase alternate line. Yeah, phase alternate line. And typically, that's not here in the U.S. The phase alternate line is what you see in Europe as a standard. So sometimes a PAL TV set bought in Europe, brought here to the States, doesn't work because it's a different standard. So every time I hear PAL, I think of phase alternate line, which is, as I said, a standard for TV.
Yeah, it's the opposite of NTSC. We have NTSC, right? So PAL. But look at the sticker I was telling you about there. Look, PAL means communications. Look, it says
phase
right there.
Alternate line.
11 meters. I'm going to have to take a Sharpie and just take that out.
But
look at this beautiful dual knob. Look at that knob. Look,
oh,
fast.
Hey, that's nice. That's a good part.
Slow. That's. And yeah, this was a buck, too. $1. Look at this thing.
Wow.
Look at
the
that
case.
Buck.
The case is worth a buck.
The case is worth a buck. And that reduction drive, holy cow.
Yeah,
so
man,
we're going to have to legitimize this thing.
Well, I wonder what the frequency range of that is. That might be able to use it directly.
Dino sent me, Dino KL0L sent me this, the specs on it and the schematic. The VFO runs from 5.44 to 5.99 megahertz.
Megahertz filter.
That's a good one.
That's the 8040. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the 8020.
And you can select the output because it's got another oscillator in there that sort of heterodynes with that. And you could select it for different frequencies and different LOs. So there's a lot of possibilities in this thing.
Cool.
So thank you. Thank you, Winterfest. We will put it to good use.
Okay, well, as everyone knows, my time on the bench is really limited, taking the shifts there at the board and care facility, but I have a couple items I want to share with. If you check the N6QW channel on YouTube, you'll see a video I posted on the Homebrew SDR transceiver that I have. And actually, this is based on work of ZL2 CTM Charlie Morris. He did this about 4 or 5 years ago. And actually, I built two of them, and I changed some of the things that Charlie has in his design, and the prototype is the one that's actually shown on the YouTube. And I'm really amazed at how good it sounds. I mean, the audio quality is superb. It's got a 2.7 kilohertz digital filter in there, and you just listen to it, and it's almost like two direct conversion receivers, essentially what it is. So no wonder the signals have presence, but it really sounds good, and you get really great audio reports on the other side. So,
you know, I just must say, as critical as I have been of SDR rigs and all that kind of fancy stuff, when I listen to Farhan's SBIDX, I am blown away by the audio quality coming out of that thing.
Yeah.
Because there's apparently some stuff that you could do in the SDR world that we just can't do in our my dumb old analog world.
Well, he has a 25 kilohertz wide IF, and that's the audio that goes into the SDR, and so you got a really clean, broad
hi-fi.
And then all the filtering is done in software.
Yeah,
good stuff.
Amazing. So anyway, if you got a chance and you're bored and you want something to do, check the N6QW YouTube channel and you can listen to the Homebrew SDR. And I asked the question, does your rig sound this good? And it just totally amazed me. The next thing is I wanted to share a little bit with it where I did actually do some real ham radio building stuff, but there was no soldering involved. And through the good graces of Dean, I ended up with a small Raspberry Pi 0W, a board he sent to me. And this thing is about half the size of a credit card. And I guess the zero is because the first RPi was 1, and then it went to 2, and then 3, and 4, and now it's got 5. So I guess this kind of, they skinnied everything down, so you got half a credit card size board. And I actually got that working on an FT8. And it really works quite well for that kind of purposes. And if you're looking for some sort of a portable operation to do FT8, this would be just perfect because it's low current drain. And last night, I had a little problem with my digital adapter. I've got the Raspberry Pi digital adapter, and the adapter was working fine on receive, but not working well on transmit. And I found the problem is a burnt-out transistor, a switching transistor, and a relay. Finally, it switched so many times that I must have overvoltaged it, and it just 2N3904 a couple minutes and got that fixed. So last
that's a
night
nice
I
fix
had,
though. It's a nice fix when you find the burned-out transistor and not loose connection or
not a lot of brain stuff going on there. The relay didn't click, so the transistor's keying a relay. I said, okay, it's either the relay, and I found the relay works. So I said, it's got to be the transistor. So you had a choice of two. Binary.
When you know stuff, you can do stuff.
Right? So anyway, last night I had it working on 20 meters FT8, and it amazed me. The 20 meters sounded pretty dead around 8 o'clock, except at night, except FT8, they were all over the place. I mean, a lot of DX on there, and I worked a couple stations. So I think if you buy one brand new, they're about $25-$26 bucks. But, you know, all the glitters is not gold, because it's really not very good with Chromium or Firefox. It's just not a lot of power there to do that. So, I mean, you click on the site and you grow a beard waiting for it to load. But for FT8, it works just perfect. So I mean,
maybe you need a full credit card size then.
Yeah, you do. You do. Yeah, you're only getting half the story, you know. But I mean, I was really impressed that you're able to do FT8 with, you know, not a lot of hardware, and it was pretty simple to get up and operating. Next couple items I want to share with you deal with parts and some parts availability. The first thing, and I guess this AI stuff is really working in the background. Things will show up on my phone, and I'm saying, "What? What's this?" The other day's ferrite cores showed up on my phone. It says, "Hey, here's a place to buy ferrite cores." And I talked about ferrite, the manufacturing, FAIR-RITE, and I found out DigiKey sells ferrite cores now. Now they sell the ferrite, FERRITE cores, not the powdered iron, but they have replacements for the same AL value for the FT3743. And they got some, what I think is pretty good pricing. If you buy 100, they're 21 cents a piece. So for 21 cents, you get 100 cores. And they're just slightly a little bit bigger, but that doesn't matter because it's the AL value that's important. So if you got a design with a FT3743 and it says so many turns, just put that same number of turns on the ferrite core. And they got thousands of them in stock. And as a matter of fact, if you get 25 cores, it's about $6-$7. If you buy one, it's 40 cents. So that pricing is competitive. And the short side is actually Amadon is not too far from my QTH here. And if you bought $12 worth of parts, they charge you $14 worth of shipping. And that doesn't make any sense. And DigiKey has like a fixed $6.96. So, I mean, less than half the shipping price, you get the same value of stuff. So that's just something to tuck in the back of your mind. I think Mauser might carry them too, but they are not carrying the powdered iron. That's too bad because those would be very useful. But of course, WADIZ, the Toroid King over there in Florida, you know, stocks all that stuff. But it was just something that's close by. I didn't have to work 2 or 3 days to get it shipped. And that's why I was looking at Amadon, because they ship right from, I think, Santa Ana or Irvine. Irvine is where they're looking. Your brother's in Irvine, isn't he? You have a brother in Irvine,
Dean? I have a brother. I have a brother in Orange County, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, the next thing that you can also get at DigiKey is MIMICS, the microwave monolithic integrated circuits. And one of those is the MAR-6 SM Plus. And the MAR-6 SM Plus is good to 2 gigahertz. And a single unit is like $1.83, so it's not a lot of money. So you can get 6 of them for a little more than $11, which is kind of a good deal. And they have some really good specs. And one of the important specs is the noise figure. A lot of these MMICs have noise figures that are like 6-7 dB. This is 2.3 decibels noise figure, which is, guys are always, you know, when they're building UHF, VHF stuff, we're always worried about the noise figure.
So Pete, for the unclean, unwashed here, what good is a MMIC? What do you do with it?
Well, it's a block amplifier.
Okay.
So you just, it's got an input and output, 2 ground connections. And it's good for 20 dB gain to DC to 2 gigahertz. So I have built an IF module with I used the Triquint AG3386G. It's no longer made. That's why I said the MAR-6 for mini circuits. But I have this module, and I just steer it. So you got 40 dB of gain. You lose about 6 dB in the filter, so you got about a 34 dB block. And it's 2 little devices, and it takes an inductor and a dropping resistor and 2 caps. And that's all the parts. And for those who are worried about integrated circuits and I can't see what's in there, all it is it looks like a Darlington connected pair of transistors in the integrated circuit. So essentially it's two of them, but everything is closely matched, closely spaced, and they're real small. And they work quite well. As a matter of fact, the very first article that I ever published in QRP Quarterly was a complete transceiver using nothing but mimics, bilateral circuitry, and it works really, really well. And I've got several transceivers with blocks of mimics in them. So it makes it really nice. You don't have a lot of extraneous stuff. And the thing that is really fascinating about this, you can look up the Mars 6 SM Plus data sheet. It only operates with about 3.5 volts, but they have a matrix that says, okay, if your supply voltage is this, put this dropping resistor in. If your supply voltage is this, so they have that all figured out for you. So all you could do is when you buy the mimics, you buy the dropping resistor. And I use a 1 microhenry choke that they recommend that you use in the source. And on my blog, n6qwblogspot.com, it shows a picture of the schematic of how you connect it up, and it has the matrix of the dropping resistor. So that'd be kind of fun to build it. And, you know, you were asking about the Plessy circuit and how it would do on gain. The Plessy circuit kind of poops out around 6 meters. You wouldn't have that problem. Same amount of stage gain, but you wouldn't have that problem because it goes all the way out to 2 gigahertz. So that might be something you want to take a look at. And of course, you can't do that with Manhattan construction. You need to have something where you can make a circuit board for it because it's so small. And of course, you can do that with, you get the CNC. So that might be worth looking at. The other item I wanted to mention is I use a lot of ADE1s, and you can get the ADE1s from DigiKey, and they're about $5-6. But the ADE6, not the ADE1, but the ADE6 has a little better specs in the lower frequency range over the ADE1. Now, the ADE1 goes out further, like 3 or 4 gigahertz. This only goes to about 2, but its lower frequency specifications is a lot better. So, but they're a little more spendy. They're about $8.50 versus about $6.
Wow.
If you had something...
I'm rich, Pete. Look at this.
Yeah.
I got 14 ADE6s.
Yes.
Guess where I got them? Ha-ha.
Yes. Yes.
In that $1 parts bin at Winterfest.
Oh,
right?
Man. How many you got?
They got 14 of them.
Multiply that times 8.
Oh, man, I'm rich. Holy
your
cow.
Gain.
But really, I love this kind of part, too, because...
I don't know if those ended up in the parts bin.
Look,
this
one little thing down here at the end, I'm holding it up. It's when you flip it over, right? It looks like a little surface mount IC, but if you take a magnifying glass, you could actually see inside there the little toroids.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The
yeah.
little diodes. Yeah. Holy cow. It's like a miniature SBL1 that doesn't need to be cut open. Oh, man, I'm so happy, Pete. This is good.
Yeah, you...
Keepers, man.
Money for $1, you got a big gain on it. You know, that reminds me, and when I lived in Mesa, Arizona, they had a surplus place called Apache Reclamation Electronics. And one day, I spotted a box with SBL1s in it. 12 of them. And so I said, oh, man, I need... This was back in the early 80s. Man, I need to get my hands on that. So I go up to the counter, and the guy says, I don't know, what are those? I says, I don't know, they look interesting. And the guy says, oh, they look like relays to me. He said, how about a quarter a piece? I said, sounds good to me. So, you know, for a couple of bucks, I ended up with a dozen SBL1s. And, of course, today, you know, they're pretty expensive, so you feel pretty good. But anyway... there's a lot of good kind of parts, and what's interesting to see is before you had to almost go to like mini circuits, or you had to go to other Amidon or someplace like that to buy them. But now you can find secondary sources, and of course, I'm a little gun shy about buying stuff that comes from Alibaba. You never know what you're getting. You know, like IRF 510s that are burnt out before you get them. So, but something from DigiKey, certainly that's got to be good product. So just some things that show up on my phone. And
yeah, I had forgotten, Pete, when I built the simple SSB, you wrote to me and said, just write to mini circuits and ask for samples. And
yes.
They sent me 4.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, they do that, don't they? I don't know if they're still sending samples, but that was a deal.
Well, I just said, hey, I'm part of an amateur radio club. We're working on a project. I don't know how many of these we're going to buy. And the salesman was really nice. He sent me four samples.
Yeah, even Mauser has a request samples box when you're buying parts there. Request samples.
Ooh, cool.
Yeah. This opens a whole new world for the Solder Spoke listeners.
Yeah.
I suspect we're going to see a big increase in sample requests.
Or it may shut down the sample request.
They'll blame it on us. I'll be getting another letter from San Francisco.
And someone will write an article entitled, A No-Cost Homebrew Single Sideband Transceiver. There you go.
All samples.
All samples. There you go. Hey, I'm good. That's.
We'll call it the soup kitchen transceiver.
That's it, man.
There you go.
Thank you, Pete. Dean, back from the North Pole, man. But I know the whole time you were away, you were thinking SBIDX.
I was thinking SBIDX, and before I left for the North Pole, I had solved my problem with.
I just got to do one aside because. Dean's lovely wife, Sandy, Dean told me a story that he would occasionally be lost in thought during, you know, some sort of outing with the family. And then he would turn to her and say, it's R16. There's a problem. I know. The problem is with R16. And she looked at him and she said something that I thought was really great. She said, do you think about these problems all the time? And he said, well, yeah, I do. This is a variation on Gene Shepherd's problem with the Heising modulator. But go ahead,
yeah.
Dean.
Yeah, there are doctors for these kind of things. So if you recall when we spoke last, I had been working on this problem with ground bounce hallucination and finally come to wisdom. And I had my SI-5351 clock working finally. So I got the SBIDX completely assembled. And then I found that it was not the frequency that was on the display did not match the frequency that the radio was tuned to. And I thought, well, it's the SI-5351, and you have to get it calibrated. And so in Farhan's build, he uses an oven-controlled crystal oscillator to fix the oscillator frequency of the actual SI-5351 at 25 megahertz exactly. And of course, the boards you get from Adafruit Lady Ada just have a crystal on there and it's going to be whatever it is. And so you have to adjust it in the software. Well, I know how to do that. So I go into the SBIDX software and I make the adjustment. I get it dead on at 10 megahertz. I test it with WWV and it's perfect. And then it's not perfect at 3 megahertz, and it's not perfect at 14 megahertz. And I spent a week, 2 weeks trying to say, what the heck, tearing my hair out, trying to figure out what's causing this frequency shift. I did the thing that we all dread, which is I tore all the parts off the board and I rebuilt it. I ordered another audio board from Eastern Europe, and it came in the mail. I got that all put, and nothing I could do could sort of. I had Farhan on a Skype call, and we were debugging together, and he couldn't figure it out. this is classic me. With I find these things that like nobody else seems to find because I don't know why. So, and he keeps saying, well, it's something with your analog transceiver because I didn't use his analog design, Pete. I used yours. I used the simple SSBIF. So I completely disconnected the audio transceiver, and I just used my signal generator to generate the signals in and out, and sure enough, same problem. It had nothing to do with the analog build at all, nothing to do with spurious mixing products, nothing to do with, there was something weird happening in the digital board that's causing this frequency shift. So at some point in this journey, Farhan says to me, what's the frequency of the crystal on the audio board?
Aha, aha.
And I'm like, I don't know. He says, you can measure it. I'm like, how the heck am I going to do? And he starts describing this little inductive loop measuring. And it's really cool because you can essentially put a loop of wire on the tiny SA, and it becomes like a little a little antenna, and you can just hold it right over the part and it pops up. And I looked at it and I said, oh, it looks like it's 12.3 something, 12.2 something. He says, oh, it's supposed to be 12 megahertz. I'm like, I don't know what that means, Farhan. It's a board that came from Eastern Europe with this audio card. He says, oh, you got to change that crystal. So I looked at it, and the crystal that's on there is actually a 12.288 megahertz crystal, which is the standard frequency for audio digital signal processing. That's what the professional, I've learned all this subsequently. I didn't know this going in, but that's what that's the frequency that they use. Now, a PC with its universal serial bus, USB, that has a clock on it too. And that clock is 12 megahertz. And the audio driver for the SBIDX ADC is set up for a USB style audio connection with a 12 megahertz clock. So now we understand, all right, now why this board has a 12.288 megahertz, I guess it was meant for a different use, and Farhan repurposed it for this sort of thing. And then he eventually gave up on using the prototype board altogether and just built his own board. But I'm still using the commercial prototype board. And so I ordered a batch of surface mount 12 megahertz crystals from Mauser, and they show up. And I'm thinking, all right, now I got to get this damn crystal off the board. And of course, I put my soldering iron in, and one end of the crystal pops up really nicely. And I put the soldering iron in on the other end, and the other end of the crystal comes up along with the trace all the way back from the crystal to the actual IC. So I have destroyed the board. And I call up Bill, weeping, tears rolling down my face. So I've destroyed my audio codec. I got to go back to the Eastern Europeans.
Don't worry, Dean. You can do it, buddy.
Bill says, you can fix it. And I'm like, damn right I can fix it.
MacGyver could fix it.
So the IC is one of these tiny surface mount ICs, and I'm thinking, how the hell am I going to solder? And it's just, luckily, the crystal, the trace goes directly to the IC. There's nothing in between.
By the way, I must point out, this is like hours before the departure for the North Pole.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
The clock is ticking. So yeah, if he doesn't get this thing, if he goes to the North Pole with this thing still hanging over him, he's going to be in worse shape than Gene Shepard at age 14.
Oh, man, it would have been miserable. I'd have been out there looking at the Northern Lights, thinking about that damn IC. And so I start scheming. I think, all right, I can do this. I said, well, first of all, I got to figure out a way. I can solder one end of the crystal to the board, and that's fine. But I got no place to solder the other side of the crystal. So I got to kind of super glue it down so it doesn't move anywhere. But then I got to get a connection from the end of this surface mount crystal to this tiny pin among 16 or 18 tiny pins on the surface of this board without having a solder bridge to the adjoining pins. And I tried it once or twice and I failed miserably. And so I cleaned it up with some solder wick. I got a bunch of, and finally I said, tape, blue painter's tape. So I made myself a mask and I carefully put one side of the paint on the right-hand side of the pin of interest and another piece of the tape on the other side of the pin of interest. And there, just glowing through the circle, was the one pin I needed to solder to. And I got a piece of, like, number 32 enameled wire, stripped off the end, tinned it, tack soldered it really quickly. It stuck, tacked it on to the other end of the crystal, and I had recovered the board. And suddenly, all of my frequency stabilization issues went away.
Bob was your uncle.
Bob was my uncle. Sister's brother. I could tune up and down the band. I could make the frequency on the display match exactly the tuned frequency. I had solved the problem. So I popped an 80 megahertz low pass filter in, got on the air, made a contact, made a recording, sent it to Bill, said, I am good to go to Alaska, and I don't need to think about this anymore. Not Alaska, the other side of the world, to Europe, Northern Europe, and I don't need to think about this anymore, and I had solved the problem. So that was my big progress, and I have a working, full-up working SBIDX transceiver, except... I'm now on to the next stage, which is a four filter switched low pass filter board. The low pass filters are very standard low pass filters. Farhan uses four filters to switch all the bands. Some of them do double duty, and it's relay switched. In Farhan's design, it's all diode switch, but it's a very complex diode switching, and I didn't want to do that on my own. So I just put relays on each other end of the board and carefully built the filters. I tested the filters as I built them, and it's one board. It's about 4 inches square with the four filters and the relays all in parallel on there, and the switching all works perfectly. And it has about 9,000 dB of loss across the filter board. So then I start deconstructing it. Now, where I got to in the last day or so since we've been back is I built a standalone 80 megahertz crystal filter, put low-pass filter, put it in there, works perfectly. But when it's in the board with all the relays and everything else, it doesn't work. And so I'm back to the, all right, what do I do about this board? And I've tried a bunch of things, none of which have been satisfactory so far. And just one last thing, if you want to see the MacGyver work, there's a picture of it on the groups.io SBIDX board. If you just put in KK4DAS, you'll find the Frequency Cal success post. And there's a picture of the MacGyver fix of the micro electronica board there. So that's kind of my story at this point.
Thank you for sharing that tale of woe, Dean. Our listeners really like it when we tell tales of woe, because I think this is a good educational point too, because as we frequently point out, this is not plug and play radio. Sometimes these things don't work. Sometimes you have to go through great pains to get them to work. And it's not for the faint of heart, as we say.
Sometimes, Bill, it's plug and pray.
Plug and pray. Yeah, that's right. All right, guys. This brings us, Pete. What point are we at the show at this point?
Shameless Commerce Division.
The Shameless Commerce Division right now. You know, I would just say, hey, continue to please use the Amazon link on the blog to start all of your Amazon purchases. It doesn't have to be ham radio stuff. It could be for a Lamborghini, anything that Bezos is selling, a spectrum analyzer that's not, you know, small and tiny, a big one, $20,000, $30,000, cha-ching, we get a piece of the action there. It's on the right-hand column of the blog. It says Amazon in big letters. Click there and then begin your shopping, and Cider Smoke will get a piece of the action. We have a similar link to eBay above it, and that seems to work, but people buy more stuff from Amazon, So be sure to use the Amazon link. Also, please consider becoming a patron of the Solder Smoke blog and podcast through Patreon. You know, we try to make some additional content available to the Patreon members, and so that it is kind of worth your while. But it's worth your while also in that you'd be supporting in an easy way the podcast and the blog, and really appreciate the support from our Patreon followers. So please try to join their ranks. And finally, I want to mention Todd up there in the Silicon Forest of near Portland, who has been producing the kits for Pete's PSSST transceiver. They're going very well. And Todd sent me one. I'm going to put one together. I'm going to build one, Pete. I'm going to do it.
There you go.
I have it, and we're going to do that. But check out the website for Mostly DIY RF. Mostly DIY RF. You could also use Todd's call sign K7TFC. And check it out, and you'll see a wide variety of kits, really useful stuff. A lot of the parts and boards that Pete has been mentioning are there, also, along with the PSSST kit from Todd at Mostly DIY RF.
Hey, and I've been monitoring the board, Pete. People are building your rig.
Yeah, it's interesting to read the postings there, because it's an encapsulated view of things we experience every day. A couple of postings dealt with, I measured the current to the IF amplifier stage, the IF module, and I'm measuring 70 milliampers. And is that normal? And if you looked at my original design, why do you think there are heat sinks on the 2N22 22As? I got those things biased, so they're running hot. but it also improves the linearity of the stage. I mean, all the things are, so then people are quibbling over, well, should it be a 50 ohm resistor or a 100 ohm resistor, you know? And it's things that if you really thought through, I mean, they're learning. I mean, I think C is the important part of the learning, but I mean, some of these things, for those of us like sitting here at this podcast, we understand, but people are experiencing anew. So I thought that was pretty interesting to see that there was a discussion, and Todd said, guys, doesn't make a difference. You know, just go forward.
You know, I really like, Pete, you sent around this morning, and I'm going to put it up on the blog page. One of the VFOs for the PSSST that had been built by a radio amateur in France. And I just looked at it, and even for my analog self, I said, this is a thing of beauty. So really, really well done. And it must be very gratifying to know that people all around the world are putting together your rig, Pete. So quite good. And congratulations to you and to Todd for making this available to the ham radio world.
The Wizard of Newbury Park.
The Wizard of Newbury Park, yes. And the Wizard of the Silicon Forest out in Portland. Yeah, right. Good stuff. Hey, listen, I got a tale of woe to share with you guys, too. Since we're all talking tales of woe, let me tell you my tale of woe. It has to do with the second version of the 1510 dual band transceiver. Now, this thing is basically a bidex, but made for two bands instead of one. And I've included in it the anti-backlash gear mechanism from the Galaxy 5 transceiver that Pete recommended that I get some time ago. The reason I built the second one of these rigs was because I had accumulated during the first build a number of parts and subassemblies that could be used, I thought, easily in the second one. And I have a need for a second rig because it'll be going with me down to the Dominican Republic probably in June. So I figured, easy, build this whole thing, build a second one. But you know, when you build a second one, even if you build it the first time, you're going to have problems with the second build, problems that you didn't experience in the first one, all right? Sometimes you don't. I did. And then also some of the problems really come up because you're learning things about the circuitry that you didn't know before. And then you were probably better off not knowing, right? yeah. Which is the case with me. So after I build the second one, I go through a whole lot of problems with different problems with the audio amplifiers and everything else. And I finally get it to the point where I think it's going well. And I'm sitting here and I'm looking right in front of me. I always have an inline power out SWR meter in the circuit, in the line to the antenna. And I just start noticing that when I hit the push to talk on the 1510 rig, very, very slightly, a signal comes up before I start talking. Now, it's not picking up any kind of fan noise here in the room, because sometimes that could be at fault. No. Even when I take the microphone offline and just key the transmitter, very slightly I see something come up, which indicates to me there's some carrier getting through, right? Now, an SSB purist doesn't like that. Pete, you don't like that, right? Mm-hmm. Dean doesn't like that, right? It should be eliminated. There should be no carrier in there. Because one day, some guy is going to come back and say, well, old man, I'm listening to your signal, and it sounds sort of okay, but I can hear some carrier in there. So maybe you need to do some readjustment. And then they'll always say something like, you should go to menu item 36 and change the setting from B to C. Talking about. But anyway, I started looking at it, and I started poking, and I started adjusting, and I started discovering that my standard solution for getting rid of carrier, because we're talking about single sideband suppressed carrier. My problem basically was that it wasn't suppressing the carrier enough. Now, I think you got to realize in this kind of transceiver, most of the sideband suppression takes place in the balanced modulator. You have a balanced modulator circuit that, because of the balance, it's balancing out. It's either singly or doubly balanced, but it's balancing out with the carrier. But there's always a little bit of remnant. The remnant goes on down through the circuit, and the remnant is usually taken care of by the crystal filter, because what you do is you place the carrier on the, if you're looking at the filter curve, you're adjusting the carrier frequency. Usually you have a little trim pot where you can adjust it. And you adjust it so that it's far down on that
slope,
on the slope of the passband of the crystal filter. And the crystal filter will provide some additional sideband suppression or carrier suppression, not sideband suppression and carrier suppression, opposite sideband suppression and carrier suppression, so that you will be in the happy situation that I am with most of my rigs, where you hit the push to talk button and nothing moves on that power out meter until you start talking. That wasn't happening here. So I started studying and asking myself why. I could strike sort of a happy compromise, but it was a compromise. If I moved that carrier way down on the passband, yeah, I could eliminate carrier. No carrier is going out now. Boom, I've got it. So no carrier going out. But now when I listen to the rig, all the lows are gone from the audio. I've wiped out the lows. It sounds tinny. It sounds bad. It doesn't sound like a nice receiver. So I go back. I move the carrier frequency up on the passband a little bit. Okay, now the audio sounds better. But once again, boom, I'm seeing a little bit of carrier coming through. So I don't like this. And I start asking myself, why is this happening here when it didn't really happen on, say, the Mythbuster rig? In the Mythbuster rig, there's a crystal filter, also a 10-pole crystal filter, but it's at 5.2 megahertz. In the 1510 rig, I have the crystal filter built at 25 megahertz at a higher frequency. Now, when I built the crystal filter, I looked at it in the Nano VNA, and it looked okay. It did look a little bit different. Where it looked different was the passband, instead of being flat, where you like it, it was kind of humped. It was kind of rounded. So I start asking people about this, and Farhan gave me the first answer. Farhan came back and gave me the answer. Mike, WN2A, gave me the answer. Wes, W7ZOI, gave me the answer. And really what it happens is that because of the Q situation, the crystals up at 25 megahertz are not as sharp. They don't have as high a Q as the crystals that you're going to get at, say, around 5.2, 7 megahertz down that area. So this kind of humped passband is a consequence of that. And really, the bottom line is, there's not much you could do about it, right? If you're going to have an IF that high, you're going to sort of have to live with the humped passband, right? So at this point, I just started to think about, okay, I might have to just live with this compromise. But there's another solution. Suppose I introduced additional sideband carrier suppression in the balance modulator. In other words, I'm using a simple balance modulator circuit using just two diodes and one toroidal trifiller transformer. I could build another, hopefully more carrier suppressing balance modulator. And people have suggested that I use the Paul, VK3HN, came in and suggested that I use circuitry and built around an old chip, the MC1496. Now, and I found out, you can get them on eBay. I got a whole bunch of them coming in. Our good friend Walter down there in Orlando, KA4KXX, he said that Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur, that great book, has a bunch of circuits for balanced modulators. So I am in business, and I'm waiting for those parts to come in, and I will attempt to stop that little movement in the meter that I'm seeing, and hopefully not have to live with this horrible compromise between audio quality and carrier suppression.
So
but you know
so
what?
I want to ask you a question, Bill.
Because
you sent a note the other day, and I want to get this out there into the world. You compared all these different balanced modulators, the two diode one, the diode ring, the SBL one. Which one had the best carrier suppression?
You know, my testing procedures are not the best in the world. So if we're talking about a difference between of like 4 or 5 dB, it could be attributed to my kind of poor testing quality. But I did find that the diode ring, especially even a homebrew diode ring, the regular diode ring, say in an SBL1, I was seeing that it was knocking the carrier down by about 40 dB. And then I did the same test using a little homebrew diode ring that I made, where I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to transformer balance or matching diodes or anything like that. And it was big and ugly, a lot bigger than the SBL1. I was getting about 44 dB suppression there. So that's the one I have in there now. But here's the thing. Your question is very good, Dean, because when you look through the SSDRA, the Solid State Design for the Radio Amateur articles on balanced modulators, they say that they have tested a simple two-diode, one tri-filler transformer, singly balanced, the kind that Farhan has in the BidX20 design. And they say that testing even as high as 144 megahertz, they tested at a 50 dB sideband suppression. 50 dB, just out of the balanced modulator. Not talking about out of the whole rig, just 50 dB out of the balanced modulator. Which makes me wonder, could I possibly do a whole lot better with the 1496? I don't know. I'll give it a shot. It'll be fun to experiment just to see. Paul, VK3HN, was very encouraging. But when I read that SSDRA article, I'm not sure. But hey, here's what I think is the big lesson from all this. We can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I think I'm quoting Voltaire there, all right? And you live and learn. Like, I wasn't even aware of this kind of rounded passband problem. I just looked at the passband. I saw it was about 2.7 kc's wide, and I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to the rounding of the passband. That is one of the consequences of going up higher in IF frequency, all right? So if you want to have flat passbands, keep your IFs down at, you know, 4, 3, 4, 5 megahertz, down there, where we traditionally build our filters. However, if you do that with a singly balanced rig, you're not going to be able to build a dual bander for 10 and 15 like I have, right? Now, can anybody notice my carrier, which is probably about 25 dBs down from the voice peaks? No, they can't notice it. When I look at it on the web SDRs, do I see the carrier in there? No. Have I ever had anybody come back?
But Bill, the needle moves.
I know. But see, and when I asked people about this problem, a lot of people came back and their response was, oh yeah, well, you just got to build another rig with the IF down around 5 megahertz. I said, yeah, but that's another rig. That's a different rig. That's not the one I wanted. I wanted one where you could go up. So I'm thinking, if the choice is between building a perfect rig for one band way down with an IF down around 5 megahertz, or building a dual bander with the 25 megahertz filter that costs you about $4 from parts from Mauser, should you do it? Should you let the perfect be the enemy of the good? I think not. I'm glad I built these rigs. I did learn something from it, but I don't think that I should let that little movement of the needle prevent me from using these rigs. I don't know, Pete. What do you think, Pete?
Add one point, and then I'll answer your question. As you talk there, it is possible to get a little bit of output with the mic not connected, but the push-to-talk tripped. And you need to look at your bias setting on your final RF amplifier. If you have the bias just a little bit higher than what you necessarily need, you'll get an output. And some of that is internally generated noise. I mean, you're not talking in the mic, but internally generated noise. So sometimes, and I'm just passing this on, you may go through all the steps that you've discussed, and you're still getting an output.
Yeah, but you know, I thought about that. There's a point that shows that's not the problem, and that is when I'm adjusting the carrier frequency, right?
Oh, you see it.
If I move it all the way down, if I move it outside, nothing. No meter movement at all. The meter movement only occurs when I found that sort of happy medium. So it's not that. It really is a matter of the cue of the filter, I think. Yeah. So
well, but I would say that, you know, if you're not hearing it on the air, you're left with a compromise that says you want to filter that high because you're using one VFO to cover two bands. And that's a result of having a 25 megahertz filter. So, I mean, if everything else looks the same, you suddenly get to a point that it's a compromise. I want this, and so I have to accept this. But typically, and from what I've seen, most of the time you hear people say filters in the range of 4 to 12 megahertz seem to be the best. But, I mean, you're pushing the envelope with a 25 megahertz, and it works. So,
yeah.
You know, you can do all these additional things. But the MC1496, I've used that as a balanced modulator, and it works pretty well. But about the best I've seen is 50.
Yeah. I know, but 50 and then some additional, some thumps, at least it's a little bit of additional from the filter.
Right.
You know, that when you talk about a compromise, we're starting out with a compromise. It's really kind of weird that in our SSB transceivers, we have the balanced modulator do most, but not all, of the carrier suppression. And some additional carrier suppression is supplied by the filter. That's so, bit of a compromise right there that we start out with that we don't really think about, but there it is.
One other thing that occurs to me as we're talking is, you know, the emails of the last week or so where, you know, we've kind of learned, you've kind of learned that the modeling software can lead you astray, right? Because you use digital software and you get this perfect, you know, passband with steep, you know, looks like an SDR, you know, brick wall filter.
Oh man, this, Dean, I'm so glad you brought that up. This gets us to what Pete has called the Dishall dystopia. And this is one of the things that drove me into this madness, I kept looking at the passband that Dishall promised from my specific crystals. In other words, I would plug in the parameters, the motional parameters for my crystals, and then Dishall would draw this filter. And it is a beautiful filter. There's no loss. There's a slight little bit of ripple. And the skirts are just so steep. And I'm thinking, why can't I, this was early on, why can't I have a filter like that? And it's only when you go in and you start reading the fine print that you realize that what Dishall is doing in that software, they treat all crystals as, quote, lossless resonators. Lossless resonators. So they completely discard the whole idea of Q and motional resistance, R sub M, all of that. So of course they're going to get that beautiful passband because the Qs are all, you know, almost infinite for almost all of the filters that they build. So that was a real big disappointment. I wanted to make sure I got that right. And I checked with a bunch of people who know what they're talking about. Yeah, that's the case with Dishall. This is why some of the other software, like AADE, when you take exactly the same parameters that I used in the Dishall filter and plug it into AADE, you get the humped, you know, passband with loss. So anyway, you live and learn. So it's good stuff. I'm glad we're going to do that. Listen, we got to move on. One more thing I want to say is, you know, one of the problems that I had with the first version of the 1510 rig was that I found the tuning was a little bit squirrely using the capacitors that we had yanked so heartlessly out of the heat kit QF1Q multiplier. So first I replaced the cap, and then I had this kind of rinky-dink little kind of Japanese vernier. You know, reduction drive, the vernier dial in there. But I didn't like that. Then I remember that I had in the junk box this thing. You guys can see it here. Look at that. Look at that. That's a fantastic looking thing. It's almost an Eddystone looking little thing, but it's not. And I got this thing 30 years ago from my old friend in the Dominican Republic, who's now a silent key, Hotel India 8 Papa. He gave it to me. So it's been bouncing around in my junk box for all these decades. And I finally decided, wait a second, I could just slap it in there and it'll work fine. And it's, look, soul in the new machine, my friends. A lot of soul was added. When I look at that thing, I think of Pericles. So we've added some soul in the new machine. All right, guys, we've got to move along here. It's time for mailbag. Let's do the mailbag real quick. Well, it's a long mailbag, but it's a good one. So first of all, Grayson, KJ7UM, I found a hollow state construction design video that he had, put it up on the blog. What a beautiful piece of work. A lot of great feedback on Grayson's video. What a real gentleman Grayson is, and it's so cool to see him doing a video on how to do hollow state thermionic thermotron building. Similarly, Mike, WU2D, Mike went out and built a 10-meter double sideband transceiver. Wow, what a beautiful piece of work it is. And I just want to congratulate Mike for putting that thing together and for demonstrating what great things can be done with double sideband on 10 meters. Now, he had the misfortune of taking it to the field during the worst solar flare crisis we've had in many, many years. So he didn't do too well. But when he was running that thing from the shack, holy cow, he was working all kinds of DX. Good stuff there, Mike, and congratulations on that. I got a nice email from an old friend, Jack Welch, also known as DACA Jack, AI4SV, a member of the Vienna Wireless Society. And he watched me making a QSO with my old Azores double sideband rig. I pulled the old Azores double sideband rig off the shelf, and I just fired it up. This is something that I built like 30 years ago. And I wanted to check out how much carrier suppression I was getting from the simple two-diode circuit, because Doug DeMore had recommended the similar circuit. So I had it set up on the bench, and I still had the scope probe from the Regal scope going in onto the, I think it was the output of the final transistor, the final transistor, the PA. And so you could look on the screen and you could see the modulation, and then you could see when there's no modulation. Modulation, no modulation. So Jack really liked this. He said it reminded him of the stories you read about brain surgery, where they keep the patient conscious to make sure that they're not cutting something important. Thank you for that metaphor there, Jack. It does seem somehow appropriate. Mike, AA1TJ, and we mentioned Dave, Alpha Alpha 7 Echo Echo. Dave mentions this a concept called the backwave. And Pete knows what backwave is because it's something that we dealt with years ago. It's when you're running the oscillator all the time, and you're keying the driver and the PA or just the PA, so that the oscillator is running even when you have key up. And I did the same kind of thing with one of my first transmitters. And every once in a while, I'd get a guy who'd say to me, "Your rig sounds okay, but I'm hearing a bit of signal even when the key is up." Ah, you're listening to backwave. Michael Rainey came in and he said in one of his, he built these really QRPP rigs. And he noticed that somebody said this to him. And he then calculated how much power he was putting out with the key up. It was 100 microwatts. 100 microwatts. He calculated that, he was talking to somebody else in New England. But even though it was a close by station in New England, it came out to more than 1,000,000 miles per watt.
Wow.
I mentioned also that backwave always reminds me of a related concept called backwash. Kind of disgusting. But this is why, as a little kid, Billy would never share his soda with his sister Maria. Enough shit. Let's see. And Dean points out this is one of the great things about being a home brewer today. It's the ability to talk to people who are really kind of luminaries, greats. Pete, we have one with us here right now in the ham radio homebrew electronics world. And Dave was Dean had some questions when he was going through his tale of woe with the SBIDX. He had some questions about this and reached out to G3UUR, Dave Gordon Smith, who created the G3UUR method that most of us use for calculating the motional parameters of our crystals. And I talked to Dave also about my curved passband problem. So great to be in touch with him, and thank you for all the input.
I think between you and I, we have revived Dave Gordon Smith's interest in radio and crystal filters.
I hope so. It'd be great. That would be a great.
Well, he wrote a bunch of those articles in the 70s.
I know. You read these articles, and we forget that this stuff was written a while back. Yeah. But there you go. All right, great stuff. Hey, this is a story that kind of gives you the creeps. I got an email on this, so I'm using. This is the little rig that I mentioned before, the little QRP rig, and I go out on 7040 and I, you know, make a contact. I made my first contact with this thing. It was during some contest or something, and I talked to this guy. The whole contact was on 40 meters. I was running 1 watt, and the whole contact was less than a minute. It was just a very quick 599, 599, thank you very much. Boop, that's it. It was some sort of contest. I don't know. Somebody heard it. Unbelievable. I get an email a little while later from Alan Wolke, W2AEW. I'd asked him about a similar problem. I'd asked him about my curved passband, and he wrote back and he said, oh yeah, by the way, I heard your QSO on 40 with so-and-so. What? That's, Pete's kind of freaked out by it too. Huh? It's kind of creepy. It is. It is. I mentioned the guys who'd been helping me with the passband problem, Wes, W7ZOI, Mike, WN2A. Our good friend Orlando Walter, KA4KXX, Farhan chimed in also, VU2ESE. Very, very good. We also got a great email from India from Ramakrishnan. Ramakrishnan sent me an article on one of the great greats of early radio, Charles Steinmetz, up there in Schenectady. We had talked about why Schenectady shows up on the dials of some of our old rigs. But this is a great article about Steinmetz. And I never realized, I guess the kind of the New York Yiddish word would be, he's a mensch. What a mensch this guy was. What a fantastic person. And he picked his own middle name. This is amazing. So he's an immigrant to this country. And when he went through, he had the chance to pick his own name. And he became Charles Proteus Steinmetz. Proteus. There you go. Charles Proteus Steinmetz. I loved it. I found a video on him and his life. The article, it's all up on the blog. Great stuff. Thanks for sending that to us, Ramakrishnan. Justin, AC8LV, he has built a receiver. Fine business, Justin. And I got a good San Francisco, another San Francisco story. We were talking bad about San Francisco, but some good stuff in San Francisco too. KD0FNR has built an amazing rig called the Toucans. Like the bird, but it's actually in two cans, and part of it is inside a pineapple can, and he has it mounted at the center of the dipole. The center of the dipole, that's an old trick, put the rig up at the center of the dipole, but he takes it a step further. No wires connecting the center to the ground. Pete, think about that. Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, my friends. So it's all wireless. So up of the in the rig, it's at 20 meters and at 14060. But he has a Bluetooth connection so he can listen, and he has a Wi-Fi connection so he can key. And he's got this thing hanging over his house in San Francisco, and it's all covered by a shopping bag. I think the only thing that needs to be added should be some Tibetan Buddhist flag, prayer flags. That would really be good. That would make it like untouchable in San Francisco. So right? If you put solar, those things up, boom, you're good.
So they have solar power to power? Charged
no, batteries? It's not solely powered. He's got some batteries inside there.
Huh.
But I mean, solar power would be in the next step. Yeah, I think so. So we mentioned him, and then nearby, very close to him, in San Francisco, is another radio amateur, N6ASD, who has built a zinc oxide transmitter using zinc oxide and negative resistance, a la Mike Rainey, very similar to what Mike was doing. And the two of them are close by. They both have dipoles up. I think they should be getting together. Frank, KC8JJL, is another guy who heard his first ham radio signals on a rig that he built himself. I mean, it's not like, okay, he built the rig and he heard his first signals. No. The very first ham radio signals this guy ever heard came out of a receiver that he had built himself. That's pretty darn good. Nate K1MUQ built a homebrew Thermatron Super Hat. Man, that was really cool. He sent us pictures. I got them up on the blog. Thank you, Nate, for sending that. Dino KL0S sent me the info I mentioned to you on the PAL CBVFO1 that I picked up on Winterfest. Airborne, Dino. Thank you very much. Bob W8SX will be once again our correspondent at Dayton. Fellas, I'm guessing that we're not going to be there, right?
You go once.
Farhan is threatening to handcuff me and take me out there, but I'm going to try to. I'm not going to Dayton. But Bob, we're glad you're out there. I'll be recommending us, representing us. Peter VK2EMU, always glad to hear from him and about the his family in Australia. Good to hear from you, Peter. We heard from Tobias Feltus. Tobias recently had his wisdom teeth removed. And this led us to wonder whether it resulted in any S-Bidex hallucinations, because there was a wisdom deficit, right?
Huh? Or did he just stop receiving AM radio in his fillings?
Rick WD5L continues to work on his Herring Aid 5. More power to you while there, Rick. I have given up on the Herring Aid 5. It is on the shelf. I came to the conclusion that the direct conversion receiver that Dean and I built with the TJDCRX project is a lot better than the Herring Aid 5. Heard from Cyprian, YO6DXE. He saw a video of a recent CW contact. He wants to learn CW. I don't know. My advice always is life is short. I don't know.
You say that, Bill, but every time you make one of these 1 watt contacts and Alan Wolke hears that, I'm like, I got to learn CW.
I know. I don't mean to encourage this. Pete knows what I'm talking about, but there it is. I do get a lot of messages like, how fast were you going in that one? You could tell the guy is contemplating a plunge into CW. Hey, but Cyprian, for some reason, we're not getting any updates on your blog. You've got a magnificent blog, but I don't get any kind of updates. So maybe do something about that and fix that. And finally, we heard from Todd, K7TFC out in Portland. He's another guy who wrote back and said that he likes CW. Now, Todd can do CW, but Todd said he finds CW superior because it eliminates a lot of the blah, blah, blah talk that we hear on sideband. But I'm a microphone guy. I think I'm just stuck in the land of microphoniums, as Tim WA1HLR would say. Every once in a while, though, it's good to get the dots and dashes out.
Well, organ concerts are hard to do on CW.
That's right. Organ concerts are hard to do on CW. That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah, you can't just sit there and say, "Oh, yeah, my back." So, you know, Einstein said, keep it simple, but not too simple. CW might be too simple. Hey, guys, that's about it. Let's see, we've been rambling on here for an hour and a quarter. This has been great. We covered some terrific territory here today. Thanks very much, Dean. Thank you, Pete. Thanks to all our listeners. And again, let us know. Send us some email on that'll hopefully keep our podcast and blog on the air in spite of the efforts of the city of San Francisco. Hey, 7-3, Dean. 7-3, Pete.
7-3's from the left coast.
7-3 from Great, Great Falls.
All right, see you guys later.
Ooh, that's awesome.
The Solder Smoke Podcast is produced once or twice a month using roadkill computers in an electronics workshop somewhere in the wilds of Northern Virginia. The podcast is available via iTunes and directly from our website, soldersmoke.com. Our blog, the Solder Smoke Daily News, is at soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Send email to soldersmoke, that's one word, at yahoo.com. Solder Smoke is listener-supported, and there are many ways you can help keep the podcast going. Please spread the word. Let your friends know about Solder Smoke, the podcast, and our blog. Put links to the podcast and the blog on your websites. Buy a copy of the critically acclaimed book, Solder Smoke, Global Adventures in Wireless Electronics, available from lulu.com.